Alright everybody, this is Smiles Lewis and Mac White, and you're listening to a special Thursday edition of PsyOp Radio. Mac, you're with us.
I'm right here. How you doing?
I'm doing alright. It's great to hear your voice. As has become the norm for the last couple of weeks, we're just hopping all over the Anomaly Radio dial and doing a special Thursday edition here of PsyOp Radio. Normally this is when Precognitive Dissonance, a show I do Thursdays with my friend Craig York, where we cover all things anomalous, including cryptozoology, ghosts, paranormal, parapsychology, but we pretty much steer clear of parapolitics and conspiracy theory, except that occasionally relates to the subjects working in strange phenomena. So this is where Anomaly Radio and shows that I host and co-host pick up the slap, parapolitically speaking, and what better person to do that with than Mac White. Mac, of course, is a parapolitical researcher, writer, and amazing comic artist who I met years ago and have been pleased as punch to be friends with all these years. And he's been pulling his weight here on Anomaly Radio, doing his own show and his own podcast, documenting his dreams, and doing radio shows for Anomaly Radio. So thanks for everybody for tuning in and for coming at this special time. And welcome all those new listeners out there. We see you and we're happy to know that there's new folks listening. At least we assume you're new because we've got higher numbers listening than ever before. So Mac has been absent recently due to some personal family tragedies, and he's talked about that briefly on our last show last week, which I think we did that on a Wednesday, right, Mac?
Yes, it was one of those days last week. We're just on an abnormal schedule
right
here. Things should be getting back to normal, though, next week. We should be doing our PsyOp Radio on Tuesday nights at 7 Central Time. So, we hope to return to normalcy soon.
Right. Well, we're transitioning at Anomaly Radio to the new summer schedule. We've got a lot planned, and thankfully, due to some much-needed technological upgrades, we should be able to accomplish a lot more easily, and carry shows at times that we weren't previously able to do, carrying some live shows that are coming from various hosts here in Austin and around the globe. Well, Mac, as always, things just keep coming at us fast and furious from all quarters, political, social, economic. I don't ever know where to start, but
yeah.
I know that you made some suggestions before the show of things that we could talk about, including some things that you, to my knowledge, never talked about publicly. That you said since the passing of your father, you feel a little more comfortable about talking about. Though I suspect comfortable is not exactly the right word.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me a little bit, or in our audience, a little bit more about that?
Okay. There's a story that my father told me some years ago that I think I've told maybe a couple of people over the years, but have never talked about publicly or written about. And it was something I always held back until he should pass away. And it fits the theme of this show, I think. It has to do with mind control. And as most people should know listening to this show, mind control experiments were being conducted by the U.S. government in the immediate post-World War II era and on through the 50s. It's known as the MKUltra project that the CIA began. And there is compelling evidence that at some point, as the years passed, it went beyond the experimental stage and became operational. There have been compelling reasons and evidence to believe that mind control assassins have been used. Sirhan Sirhan, for instance, the accused assassin of Robert F. Kennedy, and the same allegations have been raised about assassins or such as Mark David Chapman, who is still serving time for having killed John Lennon. A lot of evidence to indicate that these assassins were mind control, or at least Patsy's, perhaps, mind control while someone else did the shooting. And there have been a lot of stories that come out in recent years, mind control victims, or at least purported mind control victims, such as Kathy O'Brien. It's not always easy to know what to make of these stories, how exactly to assess their credibility, but they are compelling, and they're the kinds of stories that would be very hard to prove due to the nature of the subject matter. The idea that mind control might have played a part in the Virginia Tech shootings some weeks ago was something that we discussed here on this show.
Yeah.
Well, here's the story that my father told me. Back in the early 1980s, he, and by the way, my father was a veteran of the Korean War, and he had served in the U.S. Army in the early 50s, and in fact, when I was born in 1952, he was at that time stationed in Alaska in a classified position as a radio operator monitoring Soviet air traffic over the Bering Strait. And, well, in the early 1980s, he underwent treatment for alcoholism at a place called the Schick Center in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he came out of the treatment after some weeks. Part of the treatment involved the administering of sodium pentothal, what's more popularly known as truth serum. And he said to me that while undergoing some therapy, psychotherapy, under the effects of this sodium pentothal, it had brought back a repressed memory of a classified black op, I guess you could call it, or at least classified military action that he had been involved in Korea, and that the memory of this incident had been repressed by some sort of technique that the Army used on him. And it all came out under this truth serum therapy. What he said happened was that he and a few other men, soldiers, were sent into North Korea. They landed somewhere up there, a secret operation, the objective of which was to recover a very high-ranking officer who had been kidnapped by the North Koreans. And they accomplished this mission. They went in and got this officer out of whatever prison he was being held in there, but not without a skirmish in which my father said that he killed one of the North Korean soldiers. And then they managed to get back to their aircraft and fly out. And then the memory was erased for some reason, or at least repressed, and only came back years later while undergoing that treatment. And at the time that he told me that story, it wasn't the early 80s, it was 1979 when he told me this story, I didn't know what to make of it. I was aware of the MK Ultra experiments, because it was in the 70s that the U.S. Congress was investigating various operations, covert activities, and what have you of the CIA's, and the documents regarding the U.S. government's involvement in trying to develop mind control techniques for purposes such as this came to light. And so that's the story. Now, it was important to him to tell that story to family members and people, and no one knew what to make of it. Most didn't believe it. I didn't know what to think. It was only in the years that passed that, as I began to learn more, that I began to see it as more plausible than I did at the time that he first told it to me. And yet, who can say? It's one of those things that, well, you could also argue that in the process of undergoing this therapy under the influence of a drug might have been concocted by the subconscious mind as a dream of some kind. Maybe he had seen a movie or something somewhere and had, you know, along those lines. And there have certainly been a number of films and novels and so forth that have used mind control and brainwashing and so forth as a plot, going back really to, for instance, James Bond novels that were written before the MK Ultra documents came to light. So someone could possibly incorporate these plots and so forth from popular culture into a dream of some kind that might come out. But that's just a theory that's just as strange, really, in its own way, as accepting it at face value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was talking a lot about that experience, telling various family members, his brother, and my mother, and others, and it seemed very important to him that people know that this happened to him. But he stopped talking about it. There was an aunt of his who told him to stop talking about it. And he never said another word about it. And over the years, I never really felt comfortable bringing it up. And because really he told me everything there was to tell me in that first and only conversation we had on the subject. But I don't know, if he lived a few more years, I might have talked about it with him. I don't know. I just never felt like it would be a good idea. I didn't know how he would take it. And it was important to me over the past several years that our conversations be, as pleasant as possible and not get into anything too dark, you know.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. And even then, what could he have told me that he hadn't already? Because it comes down to either you believe it or you don't, or you just file it away in the don't know category.
So
that's the story.
This was related to an incident during the Korean War, he said?
Mm-hmm. It would have happened in the... I think he went into the Army in 1950.
Well, of course.
51. Yeah, I'm not sure. And then he was discharged in 53.
Of course, it was the film, or rather, it was the Korean War that brought to the public's attention the idea of brainwashing. The idea.
The candidate was
the United States populace seeing on the news these the footage of their boys in blue, or dark drab gray or green as the case may be, over on being filmed in Korea, saying that they were using chemical warfare agents mm-hmm. on the Korean pops. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, just today on AnomalyTV.com, where I blog the latest paranormal and parapolitical videos, I posted some footage from a really interesting documentary I've been wanting to see for a long time called Codename Artichoke, the CIA's Secret Experiments on Humans. And of course, you know, none of this is news to you or I, but this is a really interesting documentary about Eric Olson, the son of Frank Olson, whom was either suicided or jumped to his own death back in the early 50s. And you can find out more about this at frankolsonproject.org. And Frank Olson was involved in human experimentation and experimenting with anthrax and other biological agents on monkeys and other test subjects. And he was also the one who was surreptitiously dosed with LSD by his own people. But this documentary, which again you can find links to at AnomalyTV.com and under the heading Codename Artichoke, this is really scary stuff. And I had been reading that Cheney and Rumsfeld's fingerprints were on the Frank Olson cover-up during the Nixon administration, or I'm sorry, I guess it's the Ford administration, and that you can chart this American use of torture and Nazi mind control techniques from post-World War II through the Korean War and all the way up to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. And that, the people in power now are the people who were covering up this pioneering, ghoulish research back then. And some of the things that I learned in this documentary, if true, are pretty frightening. And it basically suggests, it's divided up into five parts. In the fifth part, they allege, or it shows documents, so I'm assuming this is documented, that the American prisoners of war who were on film condemning their own country after allegedly being brainwashed by the Koreans, saying that we were using chemical and biological weapons against them, that when they got home, they too were interrogated, and you would imagine they would be debriefed, but that they were interrogated with the very techniques that we had developed continued with Nazi sympathizers, both abroad, and apparently some of this stuff is what Frank Olson saw. And Frank Olson, while he was obviously the type of scientist who didn't like to be fettered by interference from governments and the military, he wasn't exactly, you know, unwilling to do some of these horrific experiments on monkeys and other primates, though apparently he did, you know, obviously even when they had quote-unquote successes and all the monkeys would die, this apparently caused him great grief. Apparently when he witnessed what was going on abroad at the hands of these Nazi doctors, Nazi interrogators that were training our own boys, he was horrified, and apparently when he was dosed, he spilled his guts, and it was obvious that he was a security threat, and it seems pretty obvious that he was most likely suicided. And so, it really freaked me out. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised by any of this anymore, but it freaked me out to think that, you know, here are these guys who obviously either had already gone through brainwashing and torture at the hands of the Koreans, or at least had been, you know, just coming out of the battlefield. And what do? But we put them through the same kind of mind control and torture to figure out what they know. And then, but one of the other things, the key things that this documentary asserts is that they had developed a way of blocking out the memory of the torture, which in and of itself is pretty mind-boggling. Anyway, some of the things that you've just said about your father's story kind of remind me of that.
Yeah. it's not implausible at all. And I have seen documentaries about the CIA's mind control problem. Mind control problem? Well, I guess it is. Interesting slip. No, the CIA's mind control program. On documentaries on cable channels like the History Channel or Discovery or whatever, in which the rationale put out there for these experiments being conducted in the first place is, oh well, the communists were doing them, and so we had to try to keep up with them, and so that's why these programs such as MK Ultra came about in the first place. There's no doubt whoever started it, which actually I believe that it probably originated with the Nazis, and then just as in the following World War II, the Soviets got their rocket scientists from the Nazis, and we got ours and formed NASA, that also they were getting some of the mind control scientists from the Nazis, and we were getting ours as well. And there was a parallel there going on as far as the sorts of things that the U.S. and the Soviets were working on.
Definitely seems so. Of course, going off in a completely different direction, there's the research of Nick Redfern, who's a Fortean anomalous cryptozoological researcher, who has written, I guess it's 9 books now, ranging on things as wild and crazy as Chupacabras to one of his more recent books on the Roswell incident. And that book is called Body Snatchers in the Desert. And it's suggesting that there's plenty of evidence that the Japanese version of the Nazi Mengele type experiments were imported by the United States military and continued in the desert southwest, and coupled with some advanced aeronautics research, and that may be the origins of some of the stranger stories of crash debris and weird-looking bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And while it may or may not be a definitive explanation for what the heck crashed in Roswell, I find it really interesting, again, that here's blatant evidence that should be very verifiable, that our government, in order to defeat the enemy, had to become it, and basically did the very things that we were condemning, all in the name of, national security, and all the while importing and assimilating the very nastiest elements that we were fighting against, the Nazis and the other Axis powers.
Mm-hmm. Didn't the term Manchurian candidate come from, I'm not sure I can remember exactly what I read, but that there were instances of, it was reported as fact, instances of U.S. servicemen who were who had been captured during the Korean War, who would, after their captivity, they would be returned to the hands of the U.S. military, and they would have these strange lapses of memory, and the allegation was being raised at the time that some sorts of mind control experiments were being done on them in places like Manchuria. And so it's interesting that at the same time that the U.S. was heavily involved in this research, dosing people with LSD surreptitiously and what have you, they were... the U.S. government was publicly accusing the other side of doing such things and publicizing it.
Well, that certainly, again, seems to be the case in the terms of the Iraq War and Abu Ghraib, you know, where, you know, we're going in there to liberate them from these abducting torturers who, you know, were doing horrible things to the populace, and yet here again we go, mm-hmm. go in there. And even if it's just a few bad apples, but the guilty never get punished, just the lower underlings. Yeah. Well, I don't know what to make of your dad's story either. You know, as much as I know about the slipperiness of memory, mm-hmm. It's you know, equally plausible, I guess, in my mind. I could go either way, you know, that perhaps he'd been exposed, or even not exposed, because I do believe in the collective unconscious, mm-hmm. that somehow he could have tapped into that, and that could have influenced his memory of his personal experience. On the other hand, it sounds like, you know, that seems like such a specific memory.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem likely to be fake, and I know that there's been recent studies that suggest that there is no such thing as repressed memory, but I think that's bullshit. I think that there's plenty of evidence of repressed memory, and that memory is very, very malleable, that people can be mm-hmm. made to remember things that never happened to them.
That's right.
And at the same time, amnesia can be induced, because if it can happen naturally, a bump on the head, mm-hmm. it can be induced.
And these are the very things that it's documented that the intelligence services were involved in researching to see if they could be done. And, well, as it's such a leap to suppose that they discovered that it could be done, and that if they had, they certainly wouldn't admit it. I think that there's ample evidence that repressed memory or false memories and that these are real phenomena, and there's the false memory syndrome foundation,
which man, its members have some of the creepiest backgrounds if you look deep enough.
Absolutely, some people straight from MK Ultra,
some people straight from out of the magazine pages of pedophile magazines around the world.
Yeah.
It's like these are the people saying, "Oh, there's no such thing as repressed memory, and thus my daughter didn't really spontaneously remember things that I did to her."
And yet the funny thing is, what they're describing, false memory, which is the planting of false memories in people's minds by these devious psychiatrists, is another form of mind control.
Absolutely.
And yet the false memory syndrome has been used to debunk accusations of mind control.
Wow. Well, it's about how we're halfway through the show. You're listening to PsyOp Radio on Anomaly Radio. I'm your co-host, Miles Lewis, and Mac White's on the line, and we're talking about mind control and how it may or may not hit home for the White family.
Yeah.
I don't mean to make light of this, Mac. I, you know, like we've said before, sometimes you just have to chuckle about these things to keep from going crazy.
That's true. It's a weird, weird world we live in. And sometimes all you can do is laugh. Otherwise, you just lose your mind.
Well, a little bit more about the video I mentioned, Codename Artichoke, the CIA's Secret Experiments on Humans. This was premiered in August of 2002, which I believe is right around the time that Eric Olson and family and company went public with their conviction that after they had exhumed the body of his father and had it re-autopsied, that the autopsy indicated that he was pushed out of the window, and that the original autopsy was concocted to cover up the fact that he was suicided. And one of the synopsis for the story says, more than 40 years after his death, the body of former CIA scientist Dr. Frank Olson has been exhumed. Olson's son Eric is convinced his father was murdered by agents of the American government because he wanted to leave the CIA. Dr. Frank Olson was an expert for anthrax and other biological weapons and had top security clearance. Forensic pathologists at George Washington University performed an autopsy and concluded that Olson probably was the victim of a violent crime. And you can find out more about that at frankolsonproject.org. And just going looking online, I found articles from the London Sunday Express, August 25th, 2002. Scientist was killed to stop him revealing death secrets. So did Cheney and Rumsfeld cover up a CIA assassination? Apparently, the memos show that they did, or that they were at least recommending that then-President Ford publicly apologize and meet with the Olson family, which he did. Counterpunch, August 28, 2002. The Secret Sharers, the CIA, the Bush Gang, and the Killing of Frank Olson by Chris Floyd. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Manchurian Candidate by Maureen Farrell. You can find that at buzzflash.com. And, of course, there's more out there in this last one. It didn't start with Abu Ghraib. Dick Cheney, Vice President for Torture and War, circa November 11, 2005, from the LaRouchian Executive Intelligence Review. And don't always fault the messenger. There's some good information in that article as well. Well, Mac, some of the other stuff I posted to the Mind Body edition, Thursday edition of AnomalyTV.com was a post called Dreams, Premonitions, and Precognition.
Yeah. And that was the other thing I was hoping that we could discuss here on the show tonight, which is the fact that in the weeks that have followed my father's death, I've had some very interesting dreams. This takes us out of the realm of the parapolitical and into something else here. I'm not sure what, but I'll just give a brief overview here. My father died about, almost 3 weeks ago. And in the week or so after he died, I had a dream one night. It was very intense. It was one of these. It was a dream where I was boarding a train, and the train began traveling up a mountain. And when it reached the summit, as the train was moving along this very long summit, I could see this great view spread all around me, this amazing vista of more mountains and these fantastic houses, and the detail of it was amazing. I was aware that I was dreaming. It was a lucid dream. And then at a certain point, I was no longer in a train, but I was flying over this, by myself, not in an airplane, but just me flying at a tremendous rate of speed over this beautiful paradise. And I had the awareness then, or the understanding, that if I wished it, I could see and communicate with my father. At which point, I became afraid. I was not ready to do that. Well, two nights later, I dreamed that I was in a house, and I was watching a thunderstorm, and with tremendous high winds, similar really to the big storm that blew through the Dallas area that night. When I was at the hospital in Mesquite, Texas, where my father was at that time dying. And it was a terrible storm with tornadoes in the area, moving through the Dallas-Fort Worth area and flooding in Arlington and so forth, very high winds. And the hospital had to go on generator power. And that was the night that I had my last opportunity to talk to my father. And he wouldn't die for another week later, but that was a very difficult night. But in the midst of it, this terrible storm came through, and outside the hospital, I could see the trees whipping around like it was a hurricane. And I guess maybe that prompted this scene in the dream. And I'm looking out there, and I can see things flying through the air, and people and animals. and then I decided to go upstairs to get a better view of the storm. And as I'm moving through this house, I'm aware that it's a house that I have been in before. And yet, in my waking life, I can't really remember it. But it's a house that always before in dreams has appeared sort of decrepit, and, you know, in bad need of repair. But there's always been this potential there that this house could become something great. Well, I'm walking through it, and I'm seeing that it has been completely refurbished. And I start going up the stairs. And the higher up I get on the stairs, the better it looks. I mean, it starts off as I'm stepping up on the lower steps. There are pieces of leaves, and there's cat vomit and stuff. But it gets cleaner as I go higher up. And the railing there on the stairs becomes very highly polished wood, and it's just lovely. And I'm moving up to the second level of the house, and I'm becoming excited to see it. And when I get to the top, I see that the stairs does not go all the way up to the second level, but but you have to then pull yourself up, and it's a difficult pull. You know,
you have to make a leap.
You have to make a leap of faith. So I'm standing there looking at it, you know, thinking, well, can I do this? And I turn around, and I see these people walking up the stairs towards me. And in the midst of them is my father, as clear as if I was seeing it in three-dimensional waking reality. His face, the way it was when he was younger, before he got older and sick. With a happier look, a more confident stride, and he's coming towards me, and he smiles at me, and I'm just this warm feeling of happiness goes through me, but that I am actually able to be with him right then. And he takes me up to that next level.
Oh, man.
And we start through the door at the same moment, and I can feel his arm, you know, pressed against me, because we get stuck in the door. And we laugh, and he says, "Ah, it's the old Laurel and Hardy routine." And I say, "Well, after you." And he walks through the door, and he goes up to that next level, and I'm standing there behind the door, and I wake up.
Oh, wow.
I woke up with a sense of peace that I hadn't had for the week or so it had been since losing it. For a time, it felt to me like I had actually been in his presence, and that feeling lingered for a good part of the day, you know, and then, of course, it gradually began to fade a little bit. It was like the last lingering effects of an acid trip, you know. And after a while, you know, it wasn't there so much. I did have another dream last night where I was talking to him, and he seemed present and real, and there was this sense of calm that I, you know, haven't really had entirely since he died. Now, what is that? You know, that's the question. Is that something that the mind does to give itself peace, or are we really connecting with something beyond this reality? And, well, or I don't know.
As usual, I'd say both.
Yeah.
I mean, well, first of all, thank you for sharing those experiences, Mac, and of course the story, the first part of the show story that your dad related, but especially the dreams, because I know so much of the time we talk about really dark and negative things on this show, and we don't really necessarily, we don't often touch on the spiritual realm, and while we may talk about things that imply another realm, you know, we might talk about parapsychology and how the mind has access to nonlinear reality, and I think this may be an example of that, where, you know, through the psychic realm, you were able to experience, you know, some more visitations with your dad that helped you through a tough time, and who's to say it wasn't really him? I mean, you know, we all carry around the living memory of our loved ones, and unfortunately sometimes our hated ones, but it's those loved ones that we try to make live on in this world through our memory of them, and it's always a pleasure and a treasure when we can re-experience their presence, and again, I'm just thank you for sharing that.
And you know, once in a while we'll have some experience in our life, one experience, precognition, I've talked about on different shows we've done together, and I've mm-hmm. written about precognitive dreams I've had that couldn't be coincidences, or we'll have some amazing synchronicity occur in our lives that
yeah.
is so stunning, and the possibilities of it being mere coincidence are so great that you've got to really look at it closely, and the rational interpretation is that it does seem to point towards a higher level of reality at work than is apparent to our immediate earthly vision. There was a synchronistic... my synchronistic meeting with Alex Jones, for instance.
Right, right.
Several years ago, you know.
On the road.
Yeah, which is an amazing story. I wrote about it on my blog a while, right after it occurred. It was completely amazing because it just so happened that day, Alex had been, he had posted the link to my Operations Northwood comic strip.
Oh, yeah.
On his website, and then I was listening to his show, and he was talking about it, and he mentioned me by name, and I thought, well, that's really nice, you know. I was really excited, and I had at that time I had just begun to start work on editing that comics anthology, The Bush Junta. And I was trying to figure out, well, I need to find out how to get in touch with Alex. I'd like him to write the forward to this thing. So that evening, Diane and I are driving to Dallas to visit my family up there. And we're talking about Alex and thinking, man, how are we going to find out how to, you know, get his phone number or something? You know? Not that easy to get in touch with. His email is, you know, so always so, you know, packed with spam that he doesn't even answer it anymore. But so we pull into a restaurant. It was the El Chico's in Waco. And we're sitting there in the bar area waiting for our table. And my back is to the door. And Diane looks up and said, oh, Alex Jones just walked in. And I turned around, and there he was walking in, you know, with his wife.
Bigger than life, yeah.
Yeah, and she hollered over, Alex, he came over there, you know. And the thing was that they had only stopped there by pure chance because they were on the way to Dallas because his grandmother had died.
Yeah.
And his wife needed to, you know, make a bathroom stop, and they just at random chose the
El Chico.
And so here we're all just really freaked out. So when things like that happen, to me it's very reassuring because it shows you that, wow, you know, there's a very higher power than we can perceive with our, you know, five senses. So that is a lead-in to an amazing story of synchronicity that I got to tell you.
Please.
The day before yesterday. It was the day of the funeral, which was of my father's funeral, which was held at the Dallas-Fort Worth National Cemetery. And right before this funeral started, my sister, you know, had gotten a call that her best friend was going to give birth to her baby. They were going to perform a C-section, and she was very scared and so forth. And Lavelle, that's my sister's name, wanted to be there at her friend's, you know, at this birth. Her friend's name, by the way, is Sky. And, but she couldn't because, you know, our father was being buried that day. So she made plans to immediately after the service to go over to the hospital and to be with Sky. Well, as I'm driving back from Dallas down I-35 back to Austin, my cell phone rings and it's Lavelle. And she says, "You're going to be amazed by what happened." She said that, and they were able to determine that it happened with the timing, no doubt about it, that I'm about to describe. At the moment that Sky gave birth, her husband, who was there in the delivery room with her, his brother, a young mentally retarded man, much beloved by the family, who had had a history of epileptic seizures, but his was not thought to be in any danger. At the moment that they that she gave birth to that child, his brother died. Because he, right after the birth, like a minute later, he gets on the phone, he calls his father, and his father had just a moment before seen his brother alive, and he goes back in there to tell his brother about the birth, and his brother is lying there on the floor, face down, he's had a seizure, and he's dead.
Oh my God.
And was brought to the same hospital.
Oh, wow.
And Sky's husband found himself having to go back and forth between the delivery room and the emergency room. Now, what can you make of that? It's the kind of coincidence that makes you think that there's some kind of meaning there. And in fact, the Jungian definition of synchronicity is meaningful coincidence.
Yeah.
But what is the meaning? But here you have birth and death happening simultaneously in that family. And I just put that out there as
wow.
Something that we, it's beyond comprehension. It's synchronicity, but what does it mean? And, you know, and of course they didn't know how they were supposed to feel. I mean, it was very upsetting. You know, at a moment of great joy,
right?
Terrible tragedy. So,
well, the meaning I get out of it is that's life. I mean, it's the great hue and cry, as they say, of good, bad, and ugly, and. There can be no life without death, or at least not the way we conceive of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is there, you know, how much difference is there between the living and the dead? When we die, are we perhaps being born again? I mean, you know, the vision that I felt that I saw that night in the dream of paradise. Maybe this is something that is existing all the time here, right now. The presence of God The only difference is that in these physical forms, we just can't see it.
Yeah.
And that when we move on, pass away from this life, and awaken in the other, what's happening is that we're able to see something that was there all along that we might have been able to see here, but couldn't due to the limitations of earthly existence. I don't know.
Right, when the veil is lifted, that's when you can see.
Right.
Wow, Mac, that's... it's very interesting stories you've brought to us tonight. Like you alluded to, you know, you've had your share of experiences with precognition, both of dramatic things and not so dramatic things over the years, ranging from, of course, the dramatic dream of the assassination of the president, JFK, to a little much more minor things that have come to pass in your own life. But I definitely think you're one of the people who has had that veil pulled aside several times and typically can see through it a little better than most most of the time. Well, we're getting close to the end of the show here. There's a few more things I wanted to bring up. I mean, whenever precognition and Alex Jones are mentioned in the same few minutes, I've got to reference the article I wrote back in, what was it, May of 2006, and that was, I think that's when it was, when I wrote an article called The Precognitive Visions of Parapolitical Researcher Alex Jones. And without reading it verbatim, that I would just say that there's only been two times, to my knowledge, as a sometimes compulsive Alex Jones listener, that he's alluded to his own early life experiences of precognitive visions. And it's only been these two instances that I'm aware of, back in June of 2003 when he was talking to Colonel Craig Roberts about Craig Roberts' near-death experience that gave him his belief in the afterlife. And this interview that he did, I guess it was in August 2006, with Rima LeBeau and General Spoonbender Stubblebine, talking about first Codex Alimentarius, the globalist agenda to undermine everyone's health, and then they started discussing psychic remote viewing because of General Stubblebine's history in that arena. And again, he brought up the subject of the precognitive dream that he had before September 11th that was basically what led him to make that dramatic July 25th broadcast where he predicted, more or less, 9/11. So if you want to find out the details of that and hear those interviews, you can find the links if you Google Precognitive Visions of Parapolitical Researcher Alex Jones. That's on my various websites, Elphys.net, AnomalyNews.com, Parapolitics.info. And hopefully, maybe someday soon, I'll get an interview with him where I can discuss that. And I know it's not a subject area he likes to talk about, and he may be a little squeamish about doing so, but I would sure love to get him on the record about that for the 9/11 book that my friend and I are writing. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is this movie Bug that's out right now. Bug is based on a play that was performed years ago, and it's directed by the guy that did The Exorcist. And my girlfriend really wanted me to see this movie. Of course, she suspected that I would say what I ended up saying after seeing the movie, which was, yep, here's a great movie that does a great job of discrediting conspiracy theorists because it mixes in wacko nut job stuff with real parapolitical conspiracy theory. I mean, everything from mentioning MKUltra to Tuskegee and to Area 51 to, you know, nanotechnology to, of all things, the Bilderberg meetings, which, of course, have been in the news this week. Alex Jones covering Jim Tucker's infiltration, as usual, as well as the Dallas Morning News, for the first time ever, acknowledging that the Bilderberg meetings happen by having a front-page blurb about our governor. Well, he's not my governor, damn it. Rick Perry going over to Bilderberg and apparently being warmly received, probably for all his pushing of those nasty little HPV vaccines. But Man. But this movie Bug, it's out there. It's interesting. It's pretty dark, folks. So if you go see it, don't expect a happy, uplifting movie. It's really well done. I mean, Ashley Judd, I believe, is in it. So is Harry Connick Jr. And it's a very interesting little film. But as usual, you know, as Ken Thomas said, I guess I know what a black person must feel like when they're watching Step and Fetch It. You know, it's like, okay, yep, that's what we're perceived as, is these nuts out there. But it's really well filmed. It's very interesting. Might take a look at it if you're interested. So, Mac, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, what else is on your mind before we close out for tonight?
Well, I think I was going to throw one more thing out there. It's another dream I had between the first and the second one that I described. I neglected to mention it earlier. It slipped my mind. But I think it's a good, interesting note on which to end this show. And it's just a mind bomb I'm going to throw out there.
Oh, no.
And we'll just leave it at this and make of it what you will. I mentioned the first dream in which I saw what I took at the time to be paradise, and yet I was had this fear of actually going all the way. And then I mentioned the second dream in which I did, you know, go all the way and make that leap of faith and, as you put it, and go up the stairs and so forth. But I had a dream in between those two, much shorter, in which it was another flying dream. And I dreamed that I was touring a vast high-tech facility of some kind. I think it had a name like Google Land. Well, I don't know what that means. And in order to take this tour, you would have to sit on what amounted to a cart in a as in a carnival ride. And it starts swinging you around and going faster and faster. And, wow, it was exhilarating. And it became this thing that was, after a while, it wasn't just I wasn't on a carnival ride. It was me flying around this enormous room. And it was at that point I had the sense that I really felt as if I could let go and experience the infinite, but without fear. And I then began to descend through the floor, and I held my hand out, palm upward, to sort of receive the winds of infinity or something. It was a very tactile experience.
Wow.
And I am descending through fire, sparks flying everywhere, but descending with perfect calm. And then beneath the fire, then, I saw this vast body of calm, clear water. And sometimes an object or two would drop into the water in a concentric circle outward that would then overlap with another circular pattern. And then I noticed beneath the water was a large eye looking back at me, and the eye was attached to a vast, shapeless form, and then I woke up.
Whoa, shades of Cthulhu, Lovecraftian, unspeakable horrors, but hopefully not.
Who knows?
All right, Mac, well, thanks again for joining us, everybody. You've been listening to PsyOp Radio on the Anomaly Radio Network. That's anomalyradio.com, psyopradio.com. And, of course, you can go to Mac's site, macwhite.com.
MACKWHITE.com.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks again. We'll be back probably to a more normal schedule next week, so stay tuned, and don't stop peering beyond the veil.
Good night.